Connect the Dots with Alison Rose Levy, Saturdays at noon, Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Alison Rose Levy, and it's a pleasure to be with you here as we are every Saturday at noon on the Progressive Radio Network. Our show goes all the way from our personal concerns, spiritual, psychological, health-oriented, environmental, to the challenges that we face in this time of mounting crises in our society for people, living things, and the earth itself. Every week on the show, we speak with different people who bring unique insight into the challenges, and very often they have wonderful books that they've written also to support us in making a change both in ourselves and in our world that is positive and favorable and kind of seeing where all the pieces fit. And I begin every, or what seem like pieces, which are actually all interconnected, but, you know, we perceive them as pieces because many of our beliefs really revolve around fragmentation, and we lead busy lives, have long to-do lists, and there are a lot of things that we don't really understand completely so that we can integrate them completely in a way that really is caring, compassionate, and makes sense for ourselves and our world. I begin every show with a featured action, and this time I'm going to make it relatively brief because I can't wait to talk to today's guest, the writer Susan Griffin, who's joining us for the second time, and this time we're going to be talking about her wonderful book, Transforming Terror, which becomes more relevant with every passing day. So I'm just going to mention the action because I can't not mention it. As many of our regular listeners know on this show, I've covered a lot of the challenges we face in protecting our environment, and one that I've concentrated on a great deal is the threat by a process called fracking to the water supplies both in the United States and actually around the world. And recently, the governor of New York State, Governor Cuomo, has issued his first plans in terms of how he plans to address the issue of fracking in New York State, with the gas and oil companies on one side wanting to come in and drill and get this gas out for energy use. And on the other hand, as the process has traveled across the country and around the world, there are many problems with contamination of water supplies, dealings with hazardous waste, contamination of food and air quality, and other things we don't want in New York. So New York just a week ago came out of a ban, that was put in place at the beginning of the year. And so we were hoping that the ban could be a permanent one, but in fact the governor is planning to get New York half pregnant with fracking contamination by, you know, doing it here but not there under the, you know, the kind of the concept that it could be made to be safe. But there are a lot of problems with that. So we've had past guests discussing this on the show, and I refer you to the Connect the Dots archive to listen to some terrific shows with Bridget Shields, Mike Bernard. We hope to have Mark Ruffalo on here soon. But for today, just please go to my website, healthjournalistblog.com, and we are linking to a Sierra Club action to protect the water of the water aquifers of the Northeast region. And there you'll find a very short blog with a link where it says, "Will New York be half pregnant with fracking?" So please go there and take action. You can also sign up under Join the Conversation in order to receive the weekly e-zine with the radio show announcements, activist links, and also my blogs from the Huffington Post. So now we will pivot and look towards some solutions, look in depth at both some of the core reasons and infrastructures and ways that we do things that are kind of leading us to the edge in a very dangerous and scary way. And many, many people, I think, feel so scared that they just kind of trundle along with business as usual and can't even face some of these challenges. And I think today's guest and today's featured book really get at the core of this in a way that that is a major contribution. So I want to welcome Susan Griffin, who is the co-editor of this book. She's also the author of many books, a poet, an essayist, nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. The book is Transforming Terror, Remembering the Soul of the World. Welcome, Susan Griffin, to Connect the Dots.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, I have to say that in my work reporting, I see all the problems. I see so many of the things, the places that we are making choices that are making the children sick, undermining our food supply, harming people, poisoning the environment, leading to ecological imbalance, you know, basically putting at risk the very basis of life on our living planet. And it's, you know, I both try to wake people up, and I also have to deal with my own responses as well as theirs, because I think a lot of people don't face up to some of this because it is such a terrible tragedy unfolding and frightening with our public officials. You know, some of them almost seem to be crazy. So, you know, it seems that we need to both look for structural solutions, but also look at the causes and, you know, what we are doing to ourselves and each other on a mass scale that's creating this. And this book does just such an amazing job of it. You feature essays from a number of incredible people, including His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, you know, Houston Smith, Deepak Chopra, Jack Kornfeld, many, 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 many more, Susan Sontag, Jody Evans, and one of my all-time favorites, I have to say, Rhianne Eisler, whose work yes. I adore. So, you know, what's going on here? You know, is the disharmony that's creating this whole scenario that we're seeing?
You know, the first step we took in the book was to redefine the word terrorism itself. And first, what we call the book is Transforming Terror, not Transforming Terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
You said it correctly, but that was a purposeful, choice, because we wanted to emphasize the emotion on which terrorism operates. Terrorism mm-hmm. doesn't work without creating terror in people, and it's intended to create terror not only in those who are the objects of attack or who are attacked, but anybody who reads about it or is in a country that is attacked or placed into a state of terror, which is not the best place to be. It's a kind of suffering in and of itself, and it also distorts your thinking. And so our response as a country has been to instill terror in response, you know, where we think people that we label as terrorists might be. But at the same time, we have a working definition of terrorism. It's not ever, you know, written out as such, but we have a kind of working definition of terrorism that's, you know, roughly we think of somebody from the Middle East and perhaps with an Islam coming from an Islamic religious point of view, and we define it, in other words, we define it according to the perpetrator. We say a terrorist is somebody who belongs to a non-governmental group who's a rogue group, who is a criminal. Well, I think terrorism is does consist of several criminal acts. But I think that definition doesn't really, when you begin to actually spell it out, you realize it's full of holes. It doesn't really work. For instance, recently added to the list of terrorist acts, even, you know, in the United States, are the people who violently attack abortion clinics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that is an act of terrorism. Throughout the American South, after the Civil War, during and after the period of Reconstruction, there were a number of lynchings, and those were terrorist acts. Everything that many of the things that Ku Klux Klan, burning a cross on somebody's land, bombing a church, these are all terrorist acts, and we refer to those in the book. All the massacres carried out by right-wing regimes and right-wing death squads in Latin America during the 80s, those were acts of terrorism. In fact, our cover was, it comes from we used a painting on our cover, a canvas, by the great Argentinian artist Claudia Bernardi, which was inspired by El Mahote. She was part of the Argentine forensic anthropological team that went to recover the remains of people who were massacred in a village in Salvador. All the members of the village were killed, except for one woman, men, women, and children. So these terrorist acts, go on all over the world, and there are many different perpetrators. For instance, we have an article by Dan Ellsberg in the first chapter, and the first chapter is meant to redefine terrorism. And he discusses nuclear weapons as terrorist weapons. Because in the first place, nuclear weapons are not useful in general unless they're used against a civilian population, because if you use a nuclear weapon on a battlefield, you kill all your own soldiers. So it generally kills far more civilians than it does soldiers. So one of the issues that we're bringing up in the book that is aligned with and very important to understand when you're approaching terrorism is that today, in whether something's officially declared as a war or not, today in warfare on battlefields, the battlefield has shifted from a separate battlefield from where people live, and it occurs right where people live, and the number, it used to be when there were actual battlefields that soldiers went to apart from where people lived, there would be maybe 10% civilian casualties and 90% military casualties. Now the casualty list is 90% civilians and 10% soldiers. And that's what's happened slowly in the modern world, and so that the state of terror has been generalized. We're all subjected to it in one way or another. And women are used to this. Rape is an act of terror. It's any act of violence towards an unarmed civilian, and it's pretty much you're randomly selected as the victim. Once you redefine the problem, then approaching it becomes a very different matter. You begin to approach it as something that we share, not something that divides us from the Muslim world, not something that divides us from people in nations in the Middle East, such as Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan and Egypt, but something that gives us common cause with the citizenry and the civilians of those nations, because all of us are being subjected to terror, whether it's from a suicide bomber or a drone.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that strikes me there is that there is a divide between, the people who, like when you say you're randomly selected, between the people who are selected to be the direct, kind of sufferers, the first line people experiencing an issue. The last time you were on the program, we were talking about, the nuclear crisis in Japan, for example. example, where the Japanese people as a whole, and especially in that region, were kind of like the people getting the direct impact. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's almost faded from most people's minds at this point in time. So, you know, there, like what you're articulating is a sense of, you know, sort of universal connection and compassion and understanding that this could happen to anyone. But yes, most people, you know, lead or their day-to-day lives, if it doesn't happen to them until it happens to them, it's kind of a bit out of sight, out of mind, because the world is a complex place. And, you know, we can only deal with our small share of it. You know, I mean, that's more the trend.
And one of the things we're doing in this book is to try to bring it into sight. And oftentimes one of the reasons it's out of sight is that it's kind of abstract, you know. You read that six villagers were killed, you know, and or 36 villagers were killed, and you don't know their names and you know nothing of their stories. And so the second chapter is devoted to trauma, and we do two things in that chapter. First, we give first-person witness testimony. Robin Morgan has written a beautiful piece, and I think many New Yorkers have probably already read it, but it's just a beautiful piece about 9/11, which she witnessed. She was right downtown there and running from the blast, and so, you know, to tie that with for instance an Iraqi family, they mother with three children in the car, and the mother was pregnant with a fourth, and her husband, and they were visiting the parents of the grandparents, and left to go out to their car, and got in the car, and suddenly there were tanks on the street. Usually there were not tanks at that place on the street, but they were American tanks on the street, and all of a sudden they started firing at the car, and the father frantically waving his hands trying to say, "We're peaceful, we're just a family," and you know, clearly the soldiers were panicked and frightened, so they fired, and they kept firing out of fear. At the end of it, at the end of this hail of bullets, the father was it turned out mortally wounded. Had he been taken to the hospital right away, he very well might have lived, but he wasn't. And two of her children sitting in the back seat, one of whom was about ready to go to medical school and was the pride of the family, died. One of them lived with severe injuries and disabilities that she's still dealing with, and the mother survived. So, but you know, they were just visiting, you know, the grandparents, something we can all identify with, and suddenly, you know, the family is ravaged and stricken with this tragedy. And of course, I'm sure that when the soldiers realized what they had done, they were also horrified. So there's another victim there. When you create trauma, it doesn't stop. The attack, the physical attack, may take place. A landmine takes less than a second to destroy a life, to have somebody lose their limbs or their life. But the consequences go on, not only for a lifetime, but into the next generation. So mm-hmm. that little girl who lived, you know, she has children. She'll pass the trauma on somehow. It passes cultural boundaries too. We have an amazing article in there by a Jungian analyst. Her name is Martha Harrell, and she was one of the founders of the Jung Institute in New York, and she was stationed with her father. Her father was stationed in Japan during the occupation after World War II, and they had a nanny. And the nanny was Japanese, and unbeknownst to the parents, the Japanese would take Martha and her younger sister and hold them by the hand, take them on the train to Hiroshima. I've been on that ride. They were in Tokyo, and they went down to Hiroshima. It's not a very long ride. Take them to the ride, and take them, and she would walk them around the ruins, and sometimes there was a shadow of a body or a building destroyed or something left from a body, and she would say, "See, your father, your country did this."
Wow.
And mm-hmm. so and her her father had died in that blast, and she was looking for her father.
Oh.
She was fairly, obviously hysterical about it, and I mean it in a medical sense, and psychologically destroyed over this loss. And so for years, Martha kind of buried that memory, but also thought of this woman as a kind of a terrible witch that treated her badly for no reason. And then she was in her office when 9/11 happened, and one of her clients came in and said, let's turn on the television. A plane ran into one of the towers, and at that point they had no idea what it was. They thought it was just an accident. And then when the second plane went into the tower, they ran outside to see the towers come down. And that was of course very traumatic for her, but it reawoke that old trauma, and she remembered it more vividly. And she went through the process completely, and that's what we're recommending in the book we need to do as a culture, as people, and all over the world. We need to learn to go through the entire process. She went through the entire process of the trauma, feeling empathy for herself finally for what happened to her, and then finally arrived at a place of empathy for this woman whose father had died in Hiroshima and was driven half mad by it. And so, I mean, that's the purpose of our book. If there's any single purpose, is for us to turn around and make common cause with anybody who is subject to terrorism in the world today, and that is just about everybody.
It is everyone, because it's mundane in comparison, but in a sense to the story, the tales of people's lives that you're sharing that are in the book. But even with the gas drilling situation, the people who are trying to protect their homes and their community and their water and all of that are actually targeted or called terrorists, and actually some were put on a terrorist list, which was by the state of Pennsylvania, which was circulated privately to gas drilling industry groups, and their act of terrorism consisted of going to see the film Gasland, for example. So there's tremendous, it's like this, the terror kind of drives in both directions. And for people who are either, vulnerable because of these things, or, they kind of know where they stand at least. But for others, it's kind of like almost there's a sense of, who is the terrorist here? And, yes, and there's confusion, yes. Actually.
Yes, there's, we have an article, first place, the misuse of the word is very, very damaging, because it saps the moral strength of the term. I mean, terrorism is an immoral act. Mm-hmm. And if you apply that to people who are using their constitutional right to protest an unjust situation, I certainly do think fracking with its consequences is an unjust action against civilians. That if you use that label against people who are just using their constitutional right to protest, then you're watering down the term and watering it down in a way that's very, very important internationally, because you're taking away its moral strength.
Mm-hmm.
And the act of terrorism, we don't talk about terrorists in the book. We describe acts of terrorism, and we describe the experience of those who have suffered from terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
The place where we go into the psychology, I'll talk about that in a minute, the psychology mm-hmm. of that might be a psychology that's shared with the terrorist. We look at it as a failed movement towards the suffering of and trauma of having been subjected to terror.
Mm.
Before I talk about that, I do want to say that we have an article by the wonderful physicist and agronomist, Indian agronomist Vandana Shiva, who talks about poverty as a form of terror, which it certainly is. And if you've ever been, I suffered a financial collapse last year, and I'm, still to some degree going through it, and just the terror of not being able to pay your bills is bad enough, but what she is talking about are people losing, you know, their land where they farmed and were able to make a meager but as far as they were concerned, a good living, and mm-hmm. and some of the farmers, because they had no hope, no way to sustain themselves when these lands were lost to corporate plans to flood various areas, for instance, mm-hmm. they began committing suicide. So it's a severe extreme poverty, which is very often created by policies of corporations or the World Bank. That is a form of terrorism. So we put the emphasis on the act, where we do look at, there's a moment at which when you feel terror, when a whole group, a whole culture feels terror, an individual feels terror, it can morph, it can transform in a negative way. It can move towards it moves first towards denial, and denial is a very, very basic human response. And we have a selection from The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan mm-hmm. Didion, which is just illustrates how powerful denial is. You know, when she decides to hold on to her, she's been with her husband through his death, witnessed mm-hmm. his death, suffered terribly from it, and then when she's going through his things, decides to keep his shoes because he may come back. Mm-hmm. You know, so that it's a very profound part of human nature to go into denial, and yet it is a process that eventually one needs to work through if there's going to be the larger healing that goes on. But one form of denial, that's a very benign form of denial and very understandable. We've all been there, I know that. But there are forms of denial that are very destructive, and I would say that the United States is seized by a form of denial right now as mm-hmm. as a culture and as a government, that we believe that somehow we can control all the events in the world, that mm-hmm. we can control who reigns in the Middle East, what their policies will be, all the factors that might lead to another terrorist act. We believe somehow that we can control all of that. We also believe that we can control the world's economy so that it comes out to our benefit. And even if we have to use violence to make things come out the way we want to. And this illusion of all powerfulness is very dangerous. We call it the heroic myth.
Mm-hmm.
So that the third chapter in the book After Trauma is called Denial, Fanaticism, and the Heroic Myth. And the other step along that path is fanaticism. And we have a wonderful piece from a book by Amos Oz, the great Israeli writer.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a book called, you know, How to Cure a Fanatic. And he tells a story about a man, a friend of his who took a cab ride in Jerusalem, circumnavigating Jerusalem, and the cab driver said, and this is an example of sort of dogma and fanaticism, which is rarely ever examined very deeply for what its actual consequences are in the real world. And he says, "Oh, let's, you know, I think we should kill all those Arabs." And so, you know, so Amos Oz's friend, whom he calls Sammy. Sammy didn't argue with the guy. He had a much more intelligent response. He said, "Oh, okay. Well, how do you think that we should do that?" And so he said, "Well," and the cab driver thought for a while, and he became, you know, sort of thoughtful. And he said, "Well, let's divide this up, and let's have everybody have a chance to, you know, and everybody contribute to this." So Sammy says, "Oh, okay. Well, suppose you're in your, everybody has a block, so you have your block, and you're going through and doing your duty, and you knock on the door, and there's a family, and you say, 'Are you Arab?' And they say yes, and you shoot them. Okay, so you go through the neighborhood, you've completed that, and just as you're leaving, you hear a baby crying somewhere in one of those houses, where Arab people lived. Here's my question to you. Are you going to go back and kill that baby and shoot that baby? And the cab driver gives a long pause, and then he says, you know, you are a very cruel man. He was faced, you know, with the reality, with the cruel reality of his own fanatic prescription for the world.
Mm-hmm. And, well, that's an amazing story, and I think we're coming up on a break here. Let's continue the conversation with Susan Griffin, the co-editor of Transforming Terror, here with me, Allison Rose Levy, on Connect the Dots after the break. Stay with us.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Dr. Vicki. I'm so excited to be on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be able to talk to you live, answer your questions, and work with you for your own patient rights. Tune in every Sunday at 5 p.m. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you on Sunday, 5 p.m.
Join me, Rachel Trachtenberg, for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art as life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination.
With co-host Julia Cunning.
Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
I'm Steve Lindman. I host the Progressive Radio News Hour. It's an in-depth truth hour, an antidote to government and corporate managed news and infotainment on the most important world and national issues affecting everyone. Distinguished guests are featured regularly to provide cutting-edge commentary and analysis not available from the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation on what everyone needs to know. The Progressive Radio News Hour is Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Progressive Radio Network, of course. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're speaking today with Susan Griffin, the co-editor of an amazing book called Transforming Terror, Remembering the Soul of the World. And before we resume our conversation, I just want to give a little shout-out so that people can follow up on the show by reading this amazing book. You have two websites of Susan's that you can go to find out more and to order copies. TransformingTerror.com is the place where there's information about the book, which was co-edited by Susan with Karen Loftus-Carrington. The two of them worked together on it. And Susan's website, where you can find all of her books, her blogs, her workshop schedule, And, you know, other audio interviews and things that she's done and is about to do that you could participate in, is at SusanGriffin.com, G-R-I-F-F-I-N. And I also want to refer listeners to HealthJournalistBlog.com, where you can sign up for upcoming radio programs, my blogs on the Huffington Post, as well as activist links. So, you know, returning to the conversation with Susan that we were having before the break, you know, one of the what we were talking about is basically terror and denial, and also you were mentioning the sense that Americans or the American government has a belief that they can control nature, the world economies, other countries. You know, I even see this same kind of issue of control in the personal lives of people I know, trying to control, for example, our environment, even in the health advice, which I've covered for so long. We're kind of covertly pandering to the belief that we can control things by saying, you know, all you have to do is choose to eat a healthy diet and get enough exercise and all will be well, mm-hmm. and you will be healthy, mm-hmm. regardless of what our agricultural policies mm-hmm. are about food, what our environmental policies are about the toxins and radiation and other mm-hmm. things to which we're exposed. You know, so there's this kind of a inflated fantasy or hope, you know, and I'm sure we all feel it individually. You know, we want to, and the more we, it seems like the more we lose control, the more we crave control and become vulnerable to forces of control. I did a blog about a week ago about James Arthur Ray, to whom people, you know, in whom people invested spiritual authority to the point of mm-hmm. following him, even when it led to first feelings of discomfort and ultimately, in several cases, death. So, yes, you know, how do we...
Well, I think these things are so linked, you know, and so, you know, it's doing this book, the two of us, Karen Carrington and I, Karen is a psychologist of 35 years of practice and yet she's also, you know, concerned clearly with politics and I'm a political thinker, but I've been very interested in psychology for years, and so we wanted to bring psychological and spiritual and even the knowledge that comes from art forms, poetry and literature to bear on this question and to look at the inside of it in some way, because the responses we have, of course, to our environmental problems, and you know I'm very concerned about those too, that the responses we have at this moment of terrible global crisis are really irrational, and it's mm-hmm. time for us to really move into them and look at deeply how we're responding, because it's not, you know, there are many good things happening, but in general the policies of nations and whole political parties are really what you would think someone who's not psychologically well, and it isn't psychologically well. It's not an efficacious or healthy response at all. And I think one of the things that drives the response we have to terrorism, which hasn't been all that beneficial, is again denial and the very fear you talk about. The very fear you talk about makes people can put them into a paralyzed state, which is why almost all the world's wisdom traditions have some form that recognizes and embraces what we call the dark emotions. We have in the book a chapter called "In a Dark Time." That's a phrase taken from a poem by Theodore Rutsky, whose famous poem begins, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see," because the very thing that makes you blind and irrational can also make you wise if you navigate into it, and all the world's religions tell you that. We have a piece by the psychologist Maren Greenspan, And it's from a book that she wrote called Healing the Dark Emotions, and I'm just going to quote you a few lines from it. We can use the energy of our most dreaded emotions to heal ourselves and our world. This is their message, because we all feel sorrow, fear, and despair. Because these emotions are universal, we are, in fact, intervulnerable. Only in recognizing the profound ways that we are interconnected in our suffering do we stand a chance of healing ourselves in a way that extends beyond balms for individual pain. We each have something to contribute to global healing. So, and you see, so, you know, the path of our book really is articulated in those few lines, you know, that if you really are willing to feel your own dark emotions, and then you can feel empathy for the dark emotions of others, and that can move, that moves you towards empathy, that moves you to feel, if you feel what I feel, then we can have a common cause there. You know, that's basically the basis of democracy, by the way. When we say equal rights for all, that doesn't mean you get rights only because I agree with you. You have the right of free speech, even if I disagree with you, because I know that you feel you need to articulate what you believe as much as I need that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that common cause, that empathy, is what knits a society together and allows for civil society and a peaceful life to continue. And that's what we need in the world today, too.
Very much so. When you were talking in the earlier part of the show about the loss of moral resonance that comes from the misuse or misdirection of a term like terrorist or terrorism and stuff, I was thinking immediately about the incredible, that the gyroscope of ethics and moral fiber appears to be sort of off course, you know, in public life, certainly in public governance in the United States. How do you connect that to this?
I think it's all part and parcel of the same thing. And, you know, if you look at the people who are accumulating so much money at the top, and, of course, there are some really quite incredible people like Warren, such as Warren Buffett, and many, many people who are very generous and mm-hmm. and happen to have ended up with wealth, but who share mm-hmm. it with others and put it into good causes. So I'm not talking about people who have wealth, but people who keep accumulating it in a way that is heedless of the effects of their accumulation, both on the environment and on whole societies. And also on others, creating poverty as they accumulate more money. There's sort of no sense that you know there's only really so much to go around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't pay, you are part of the tax burden. Then somebody who has far less than you is going to have to pick up the bill, or some child is going to have to go without an essential part of his or her education. And so there's this that movement that very what we call greed, I think is we often look at it as if it's somehow somebody who's eating too much at the table, but it's not sensual. It doesn't come from sensual pleasure. It comes actually from fear. Sort of like if I become the most powerful person, then nobody can get me, and I'm above, you know, all the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, but in fact none of us are. And this is part and parcel of the Western, the European illusion, which is not universal in the West, but it is a dominant point of view, that somehow we can be above the fates. And that leads actually to make us more subject to the fates. If there were a moral story more eloquent than global warming, I don't know what it would be. So the very effort to make ourselves above earthly process, we are destroying the way that the earth nurtures us and keeps us alive. And, you know, so an acceptance of mortality, of frailty, of vulnerability is a very, very important process, of part of this process, and that's what we address in the chapter called In a Dark Time. And we follow that with another chapter called Justice, out of the recognition that when crimes have been done, they need to be Lawrence Wechsler quotes a committee of people agreeing at one point is a process of sanctification, that justice, that calling, you know, naming a public crime, naming the perpetrator, is another contributor to this chapter, Terry Gent says, it's a sacred process, in the sense that it puts us all morally to rights if we name the act of violence and name the perpetrator. And so we have an article in there about it's the first time in the last 10 years since the beginning of time that that the international bodies of justice have named rape as a war crime. Theodore Marone, a distinguished jurist who was the head of the tribunal after the wars in the former Yugoslavia, writes an article about finally officially calling rape a war crime. And equally important was bringing people in Latin America who were the torturers and the death squads to justice, to name those events as crimes, because as a society we can't move forward until we know what is right and what is wrong, until we know what we agree upon about that.
I mean, that immediately brings to mind, you know, and this will date the show slightly because it's sort of timely, but I'm not so much interested in the legal aspects of it, which we, you know, are unfolding and much is unknown and everything, but more in the, you know, the sort of symbolic resonance of the situation with Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the former head of the International Monetary Fund, who stands accused, and as we record this show, we don't really know the outcome. He's recently been released on bail, but, you know, for, you know, non-consensual sex of a, you know, someone who's working in the hotel cleaning his room. Mm-hmm. And because of her past history, et cetera, she's, whatever happened, because we really don't know, but she's recently been somewhat discredited as a witness because she has a history of either being raped or sexually abused or so claiming. I'd love to hear if you have any comments about that.
It's a very thorny case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she apparently claimed that she had been raped when she had not been to get into the United States. Now, as a friend of mine said to me, you know, it's understandable that somebody would do that if they were perhaps fleeing a situation that was more subtle, even terrible poverty, and desperate to get in the United States, and so they tell that lie. But on the other hand, you do have to have a system of justice.
Mm-hmm.
That examines the testimony of witnesses. That's terribly important.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there is another woman who's now coming forward with the charge that he raped her, a woman in France who was actually, you know, not a member of his family, but a member of his extended intimate, you know, a family friend,
mm-hmm.
the daughter of a family friend. And so, there does clearly appear to be some sort of pattern on his side here too, and how to get to that is difficult. But gender is one of the issues that we talk about in the book, and not gender as something that's fixed, but gender as a sort of training. And there's a wonderful article by Leila Ahmed, who's an Egyptian writer. And her book is, her very beautiful book is called Border Passage, and we took a section from it. And she talks about the gender differences in Egypt at the time and how there was the religion that she was raised in, which she calls the woman's Islam, was a completely different religion. It emphasized peace and love and serenity, and not that all men who are Muslim don't enter into that part of Muslim religion either, but she felt that gender difference very strongly and talks about it very beautifully in the book. But the way we talk about gender is similar to the way that Rihanna Eisler talks about it, and we have a wonderful piece by her in the book too in the last chapter about partnership. I'm sorry, it's not in the last chapter, it's in the chapter on gender. And she says that what we have now is a society of domination. And we value domination. We arrange people according to dominant scales. And the classic paradigm case of domination is man over woman. And of course that defined Western society for centuries. But that really what we need to evolve to, and it really is a process of evolution, both moral and psychological, is to a society of partnership where we work together. And whatever qualities that men and women have, because of social construction or biology, that these qualities can work together to create a better society, and that is a truly egalitarian society. So we think that that's part of the whole, that if you have a society structured along the lines of domination, that is a subset of that, an effect of that system is going to be some form of terrorist violence. Terrorism will occur from a society which is arranged according to power. The more dominant are the ones who have more power.
Mm-hmm. So in fact, there's a continuum between the political structure and economic structures of inequity within a society. You know, as we go off course from egalitarianism and justice and all of those kinds of issues. So as we tilt off course, as we are rather radically doing right now, and then there's also a reflection, and that gets broadcast out on our attitudes toward the environment. It gets broadcast out on a global scale to what we do in the world and with other peoples and other countries, and then what comes back to us. But what you're also saying is that it actually goes right down into our everyday interactions. In both relationship, in work relationships, with other human beings, these same kinds of questions as to how we partner. Do we partner in a more egalitarian partnering style, or do we dominate and control as individuals and with each other on a regular basis? And what are the norms of relationship around that? Even
and these things. There's a reason that we often will conflate public events with personal events in a way that on the surface maybe we don't understand why, but we do. I wrote about that in A Chorus of Stones and the development of nuclear weapons and how I conflated certain of my personal events in my life, my family's divorce when I was very young and me being moved around from one place to another with the development of the nuclear weapons. And my co-editor, Karen, Karen Carrington wrote a piece about her mother's death in a train accident. She was in a train going across the Dakotas with her father, who was a newly commissioned naval officer, and her mother went into the forward car and was killed when the train crashed, and she and her father were in a car that wasn't affected in the back, and she was just two. But she's always conflated her mother's death. Not only was it, were there a lot of naval personnel and military personnel in the train, but the news that day, the day of her mother's death, was of the bombing of Nagasaki.
Oh my!
And she's always conflated those two, and she conflates it also with the loss of the mother, and the mother being the principal in our society. There's the Virgin Mary, there's Avalokitsara, there's the idea of the woman as as the holder and representation, symbol of compassion. And we have a chapter devoted to compassion. Of course, it's not just women who can feel compassionate. One of our great spokespeople for compassion now in the world is the Dalai Lama, and he writes a piece in the chapter on compassion. And we have a piece by the psychologist Daniel Goleman, who talks about us and them, that way of splitting. You know, there's the enemy and there's us, and that's one of the, us and there's that's one of the reasons that we don't generally talk about terrorists. We talk about people who commit terrorist acts, and we talk about acts of terror. But terrorists, unless you have a convicted criminal, and then you need to bring that person to trial. Yes, you need to bring someone to trial for committing a terrorist act. But to divide the world into good and bad, you know, all Arabs are bad, all Muslims are bad, you know, that's, of course, the same kind of thinking that terrorism is based on. That's what led to the bombing of the church that killed the five little girls in the South during the 60s. Mm-hmm. And we also have a piece, because compassion, as you say, goes not only towards other human beings, but towards all living beings. And the Dalai Lama, every religious tradition includes that concept. We have St. Francis of Assisi in the Christian religion. Judaism includes that concept. Fritjof Capra writes a piece about interdependence. We place that in a chapter on compassion, because to understand our position in the world, to understand how we survive, how we best live, we must understand that we are interdependent, that tree that I'm looking out my window and seeing a tree, and if that tree starts to fail in some way, that's a sign that perhaps my health is being affected too, because we're all in the same system, and I'm breathing in the oxygen that tree lets off in the process of photosynthesis. It's taking in my carbon dioxide. So we're all in an interdependent system.
Thank you. That is beautiful. We're coming to the end of our show fairly rapidly here, but that's a absolutely beautiful note to end upon, and really the core reality. Thank you so much, Susan, for being with us once again. It's always a pleasure. And you have an open invitation, whatever
thank
writer
you.
Are involved with.
Thank you. It's
come
wonderful
back.
To be here.
And I highly recommend that our listeners seek out your book, Transforming Terror. You can see how rich and full of wisdom we need now from many different sources, that book. So thank you so much, Susan. Check out Susan's website, susangriffin.com. And as we conclude this Connect the Dots show, I invite listeners to come back next week at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network to be with me and my next guest on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and thank you for listening. Mawale, 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 mawale.